I think we'll start since you all are here on time and that you don't have to wait. And if people come in a little late, that'll be okay with us as well. My name's Lynn Ogden, and I'm here with my colleague, Rob McGavick. You may have met us before as we come over here to give talks about every year. And we're part of the Employee Assistance Program. We're both counselors there, and we hope everyone here has heard of Employee Assistance. We call ourselves EAP for short, because Employee Assistance Program is a big mouthful to say a lot of times throughout the day. It's the free confidential counseling service that the city makes available to all city employees. And it's available to you, your spouse, your partner, your children who are from age 13 and up. For those of you who have little children, not 5 months maybe, but we have counselors on staff with expertise in the area of child development and children's issues. And I actually do work with parents with babies this little if they don't sleep well. So we'd be happy to consult with you about those young children's needs. And if it looked like your child needed a therapist, we'd try and help you find someone who accepted your insurance if we could. It's a completely private service. The city doesn't ask who comes, and we don't offer. We just send numbers. And so you don't have to be concerned about your privacy in any way. We're located in the Broadway Medical Plaza 3, which is across from Boone Hospital Center, and we're on the third floor. It's incredibly handy because if you park on the top level of the parking garage and come in that door, we're to your immediate left. So it's really easy to get in and out of, and it's new space for us, so we'd welcome you to come and see us. As you might guess, people come for counseling for every reason under the sun. It can be a worry that hasn't bothered someone very long, or it can be a chronic issue. It can be an issue in a personal relationship or one at work. You might have, I'm sure the city doesn't, a difficult coworker or supervisor that you want some strategies to talk about. You could have an issue with alcohol or drugs, or have someone in your family who does and need help with that. You could feel stressed or depressed, our topic for today, whatever the reason. But one thing we know for sure, Rob and I and the other four counselors at EAP, is everyone who comes has such a sound reason for coming, something they really want to address and consult with us on. And if that ever occurs in your life, we hope you'll keep us in mind and come and see us. So we're often asked to speak on a variety of things, and we're asked to talk about stress and depression today. But if you know Rob and I, we like to put our own slant on things. And we wanted to talk with you about how stress and depression can reveal an opportunity to have greater contentment and happiness and well-being in your life. And if the thought of combining those two sort of makes you want to roll your eyes at first or think, what are they talking about? We have faith. We have faith that by the end of our time together this afternoon, you'll each walk out with at least one idea that you can put in place right now that could add to your sense of well-being over the holidays and any day thereafter. And so we hope you'll be open to that as well as we are. The reason we believe that feeling stressed or depressed can actually lead to an opportunity is because they can serve as a red flag in anyone's life. When you're starting to feel more stressed than usual, more sorrowful than usual, or more nervous or worried than usual, that can be that sign of, I really need to start looking at my own life. I need to be paying attention to how I'm thinking, feeling, and behaving. And that's going to be our focus today. I want to start out by talking about how you view yourself. And don't let me confuse you. I don't want you all to leave here in 45 minutes and think, I am all that, you know. That's not the attitude I'm talking about at all. I just want you to consider that rather than thinking about yourself and that leading to conceit or arrogance or being better than anyone else, when we consider ourselves and our own worth, then we're not being conceited or arrogant. We're actually viewing ourselves as a creature of value, and that's a really critical thing. It isn't, however, about becoming self-absorbed and thinking about yourself all the time, because in my experience, not only as a person, but as a therapist, the more we think about ourselves, often the more stressed and depressed we actually become. We spend too much in our head, too much time thinking about ourselves, how we did this, how we did that. I want you to consider instead thinking about yourself as worthy, getting away from that belief system that everybody is noticing you, and so you have to be so self-conscious. I'll give you two quick examples. Have you ever dealt with someone and they were a little bit irritable with you, and that was outside the norm, and you find yourself thinking, well, I wonder what I did. I wonder what I said. I wonder what it was. How was this about me? Instead of thinking, well, I wonder what they could use today. I wonder if they need a little kindness or compassion. Maybe they need a little space. But we're so quick to think it's about ourselves. Another example is if we make a mistake and we conclude, everybody noticed. You know, I put my foot in my mouth, everybody noticed. My favorite one is, I fell on the snow and I wonder how many people looked. Before we even think if we're hurt, we're worried somebody saw us and that we looked foolish. So I want you to consider getting out of your head a little bit and thinking of yourself that way, and instead get into your head thinking about your value as a human being. There are very distinct differences, and that's what I want you to pay attention to, that self-worth. Self-worth is all about acknowledging that we matter, that we're taking up space on this earth, and it's space that is ours to have. And sometimes we just get away from considering that. We need to consider that every one of us, everyone in this room and outside of this room, is on a journey. And we don't get to know what that journey will hold, but we do get to know that we're capable of being on the journey. It's not a matter of, I deserve this, I deserve that, I'm entitled to it. It's instead of knowing, you're a creature of value. Are you vulnerable? Yes. Are you brave? Yes. Will you have times of sorrow? Yes. And happiness? Yes. But it's all about that being worthy. Instead of jumping to that conclusion, I'm not good enough. We have the I'm not good enough in a lot of aspects of our life. It can be as simple as, I'm not good enough to take that class, or I'm not good enough to seek that promotion, or simply, I'm not good enough. And I want you to replace that with, I am enough. It's three words, but it's a very powerful phrase. The other reason it's so important to learn to love oneself is none of us can give away something that we don't already have. Lunchtime, I'd love to give you all peanut butter sandwiches, but I don't have any. If I don't love myself, I don't have love to give. We trick ourselves into thinking we do because we love so many people in our lives, but to love fully without criticism and contempt and those difficult parts of relating, we need to love ourselves first. So I want you to ask yourself a series of questions right now just to be thinking of, how much love am I offering myself? And one of them is, do you speak kindly to yourself? We talk to ourselves in our head all the time. Are you kind or are you a critic? Do you talk to yourself more meanly than you would talk to someone that you love in your life? Talk the same to you. Do you express appreciation for yourself? Do you notice what you've done well? Do you mention it in your head? We're talking in our heads a lot, so pay attention. Do you offer yourself positive attention physically, mentally, and emotionally? Do you make sure you're attending to all those needs in your life that matter so much? Do you offer yourself forgiveness? We make mistakes all the time. We don't intend to most of the time. And so when you've made a mistake, and you've apologized, and you've made amends to someone and said, this is what you can count on me to do next time, do do start the process of forgiveness. I promise you, if you're going to be good at forgiving someone who harms you, you first need to figure out how to forgive yourself when you're the one who's caused the harm. Do you use your influence in your life? You know, do you sit back and think, I have no impact over anything that's happening to me? Do I influence my life? Have enough love for myself to do so? Do you believe in yourself? Do you take your own advice? How many of you have ever offered advice to a friend or loved one? Most of you? I have. Rob and I, part of our business, part of our profession, is to be advising people some of the time. Well, we can get caught up in giving wonderful advice to everyone but us. So take your own good advice. It can help you love yourself. This is approach is about nurturing what you want to have more of in life. So if you want to have more positive experiences rather than the negative ones, nurture the self-love kind. It doesn't mean you won't have any negative experiences, because we can't simply be content and happy all the time. We will have negative experiences. But it does mean you could look at the negative experience and think, what's the opportunity here? There has to be an opportunity in this somewhere, even if the only opportunity is learning what to avoid. But a lot of times the opportunity is, I could do this more effectively next time. It can even be, I'll speak more kindly to myself next time, just what I talked about before. It's important to pay attention to how you sabotage your feelings of self-worth. One way is through being a perfectionist. In our culture, we kind of trick ourselves, especially in the workplace, to think striving for perfect is the ideal. Well, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad tidings, but there's no way to attain perfection. It's just impossible. So we need to measure ourselves differently. Not by whether we did something perfectly, looked perfect, said it perfectly. Instead, you can ask yourself questions like, did I work hard at this? Did I do my due diligence? Did I prepare for it? Did I ask the questions I needed to ask? Did I speak positively and kindly? Did I have good manners? Did I take care with my appearance, even though it's not perfect? All those things are ways to measure ourselves accurately and then conclude with a more loving answer. But we have to fight against that desire to be perfect. A second way we sabotage our, it's harder to say than I thought, sabotage ourselves is through comparison. I'm just going to give you two examples, but there's lots of ways we compare. One way is we compare our present life to our previous life. I don't mean metaphysically, I mean our past. And we conclude that what we used to have is better than what we currently have. We had a better job, or we liked our boss better. We liked how we looked better. When you get to be my age, you could do a lot of that, looking better in the past. We had a relationship we felt more successful in. The problem with that kind of comparison is, we don't have any influence over the past. We only have influence over the day we have. So if you're comparing your present day to your past, you're bound to feel dissatisfied. The other very common way we compare ourselves is to compare ourselves to another person. When we do that, we do two things. We compare ourselves to someone else and decide they are better than we are, smarter than we are, whatever the conclusion is, or we compare ourselves to another and decide we're better than they are. The outcome is the same. You feel negative either way. It is not a good outcome. It's not a way to determine your value, because everyone is different. So that comparative thinking gets in the way of your self-worth and in acknowledging your own love for yourself. So it's good to avoid. I think there's one exception to this. I'll point it out. I think we can compare ourselves to another in terms of a habit that someone has that we think is a great habit. If I'm working with someone or socializing with someone who's particularly friendly, or they're very generous, or they're punctual, or whatever the habit is that would be valuable to you, and I decide I want to practice that habit because I've seen it in someone else and I admire that trait, by all means, add the habit. That's another way we expand our love for ourselves. A third destroyer of self-worth is seeking approval from others and desiring to please them. I'm not saying that's not a normal human thing to do. Of course we want people to be pleased with us. Where we run into trouble is we start letting it matter too much, that we care too much what someone else thinks and feels about us more than what we think and feel about ourselves. The problem with approval seeking is we simply can't succeed in it across the board. There could be one person in this room who's thinking what I have to say is valuable and approve of that, and there could be two others who don't think there's any worth in it to them. So if I measured the worth of what I'm saying by what everyone thought, I wouldn't really know if I did well or unwell. So we need to measure ourselves, we need to affirm ourselves by what we value and believe in. Instead, we can behave in ways and we're constantly looking for someone to say, great job, or attaboy, or that a girl. You may notice this with your children. When my girls were little, one of my best friends in St. Louis, her kids were the same age, her girls, and she called me one day and said, my daughters are addicted to praise. I said, what do you mean? She said, everything they do, they go like this, to look up to her to say, great job, honey. And I think we can recognize it in children more than in ourselves, but we can get in the same habit. It can really, really be powerful to say to yourself, wonderful job, and know that you can count on your own judgment to know you really did well. It's so important. The other way we get hung up with approval seeking and pleasing others is we start pretending to be someone that we are not. You know, there's talk around the lunch table about everybody saw this same movie and they thought it was great, and you're sitting there thinking, I didn't think that movie was so hot. But you say that it is because you want to be approved of. You give up your authenticity, and when we love ourselves, being authentic is a key part of loving oneself. So I like to keep in mind, remember to be yourself. Everyone else is taken. So just be you. It's worth enough. So instead of approval seeking, measure yourself by what you value. Are you an honest and kind person? Are you respectful and courteous? Whatever your value and belief system is, are you living accordingly? I'll give you one example of how we can have a value that doesn't work very well in relationships, and that is, I'll be kind and respectful and courteous if you will be. Well, we're having our own self depend on someone else. Instead, pick your values and act accordingly. I'm going to switch to the topic of happiness before we run out of time. If you want to have less stress in your life and less depression, practice some habits of happiness. The good thing about happiness habits is when you practice them, you actually become happier. They work. One of the habits of happiness that I'd encourage you to try is to connect often with others. We tend to not do that enough in life. We wait for others to speak first or initiate the conversation, and instead, we can each do that ourselves. It takes courage to do that. We have to have some self-worth and vulnerability to do so. If you grew up in my generation, which many of you didn't, it would have been getting the courage to ask someone to dance at a school dance and not being terrified. Take risks to connect with people, because it's through connecting that we often feel the happiest. If you want to be happy, smile often. Show that you have a sense of humor. Be playful. Don't feel so worried about looking foolish. Have you ever been around children dancing? If you ever go to Cooper's Landing in the summer, they'll have a little band. The last time I was there, two little kids are dancing. They're twirling around and waving their little arms. What were the grown-ups doing? Watching. I so wish I could tell you I was brave enough to dance and that my husband wouldn't have been like, oh goodness, if I had, but I wasn't brave enough, and maybe next year I will be. It's back to taking that risk, being that playful part of you that you have within you to be. It's part of, to really truly be happy, one of the best habits you can practice is to decide to be a participant in life rather than a spectator. When we're spectators, we tend to become judges and not in a kind way. We're evaluating others. When you're in it, you're not judging so much. One of the best ways to be a participant in life, if you're feeling sad or discouraged, is to volunteer at something. It'll get you out of your head and into life just like that. It's a really powerful thing. There are all kinds of virtues that are identified that lead to happiness. Love, forgiveness, mercy, having a zest for life. One of them is gratitude that I always work in before I end any talk. The reason I always include gratitude is because all the research is showing that the one character trait most connected to our mental health is having gratitude. So I invite you to have a conversation with someone in which you express gratitude for them. Write a gratitude note to someone. Tell them what you're grateful for. I'm not opposed to technology, but I tell you, if you write it yourself, it's a more powerful note than if you type an email. Keep a gratitude journal. End your day listing 5 things, people, conversations, whatever you choose that you're thankful for that day. If you have a day with difficulty, you can include that in your gratitude journal just by asking yourself, okay, is what I went through today, did it allow me to be more forgiving? Did it allow me to be patient and tolerant? What did it offer me? I want to encourage you to practice these ideas of loving yourself, practice these habits of happiness, because there can truly be a correlation between those habits and lessening the stress you experience around the holiday and any day, and any feelings of depression and sorrow that you may feel. So now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Rob.
A great room in here. I like this. So if, I didn't know we were going to be recorded, so does this shirt make me look fat? Okay. Thank you. That's the end of my presentation right there, you know. I mean, that's all I was going to say anyway, you know, really. So well, I so appreciate listening to Lynn, because every time she speaks, she brings up some different ideas that I haven't heard yet that I can apply to myself. I really mean that. It's just important to look at different ways of viewing life and learning things. I think that's what life's all about, is learning things. And the topic of stress and depression, I like that Lynn said we have a different slant. I will talk a little bit about clinical depression, some of the symptoms. I'll mention those to you because I think it's important to at least know about them. Some people, 10% to 20%, can suffer with some clinical depression and not even realize it. But I'll get to that in a minute. So there is an upside. The upside, as Lynn mentioned, is that we do have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to learn how to improve our life, you know, to find our way out and to hopefully learn some ideas that keep helping us all along the way in life. I happen to believe that life is precious and that our purpose in life is to improve, you know, and I think I haven't found anybody that disagreed with that. They might say it differently, is to improve ourselves, and it usually has something to do with to be more helpful, more caring, more loving person, and then I'd like that Lynn pointed out, yes, and toward ourselves as well. Because if we're not being what we want, you know, we have to learn to love ourselves. Foundationally, if we don't do that, we aren't bringing the right stuff to the equation other to other people. We have to be the change, so to speak. So I'm going to speak to the. Have you heard the term CBT? It's in our business. It's called cognitive behavioral therapy. And what it is basically is just learning how to think more effectively, you know, learning how to process feelings more effectively, so that we don't get derailed. And the most powerful device that we have for that, and each of us has for that, is a very powerful electrochemical computer called the brain. Okay? So the brain, it can be likened to the hardware of a computer. Now, computers need software, right? And operating systems. And so software, what I consider the mind to be, is the current software that is running. Current software, that's your mind. Okay? So what I mean by software? Software is programming, basically. And what programs us in life? What do you think, how do you think we learn things in life? Can you make a couple comments to me about that? How do we learn about things in life, about how to do life, about marriage, about conflict resolution, about how to succeed? Where do we learn these things? Pardon? Yes, absolutely. Who are the primary people? Who are the primary people supplying those examples to us usually? Parents or caregivers, whoever they were, you know, for better or for worse, right? Okay. So not all of our programmers, the people we're learning from, and we also learn from life experiences, peers, culture, other things as well. So the programming we get is sometimes faulty. We have all this incredible amount of massive amounts of data that are going in through the senses, and we don't even realize it's inputting all the time. And then it gets filed away, and then everything we come up against, we search, the mind automatically searches through the files and it comes up with a response, okay? Again, for better or for worse, okay? And it depends on what's filed away in there. So unfortunately, if the programming is not so good, the brain, the mind, can work against us. And for some, it can even do them in. Okay, and that's what can happen with, especially with clinical depression. We're going to get to that more in a moment. So what I mean is the mind can have a mind of its own. And you know that's true because sometimes you're probably asking, why can't I quiet my mind down? Why is it just buzzing on about something? Or where did that ugly thought come from? Wow, that's weird, you know. Everyone has intrusive thoughts. Everyone does. And to some extent. Now, if they're to a high degree, we have something called OCD. You ever heard of that? Obsessive compulsive disorder. That means thoughts are just dominating someone, you know, the fear-based thoughts and phobias and things like that. But most of us have intrusive thoughts. And where do they come from? Well, they bubble up out of this old programming. So thoughts aren't our minds are not necessarily who we are or what we are. That's kind of a hard one to chew on because we all kind of tend to rely on our minds to be everything about us, you know. But if it's, in fact, the software that's running and it has bugs and viruses and malware in it here and there, I don't want to be that, you know. I don't want to be that part of it. And so the basic programming can be contaminated. Now, the very good news is that once we comprehend that we're doing the best we can with the mind we have, but we comprehend that, if computers need programming, the brain's like the computer, then there must be a way to reprogram the mind. There must be a way to remove the malware, the viruses, and the bugs. Okay. So how is that? And it's important to do so because there's a very famous author and a publisher named Louise Hay. I think she's still living. She's pretty old now. She was really big in the AIDS movement in California when it first broke, you know, and everybody was freaking out about AIDS and don't want my kids around it and all that. And she was an incredible support during that, a therapist. But she publishes books that are helpful to people, and her publishing house is called Hay House. And she publishes many authors. I don't know if you've heard of Wayne Dyer. He's one that publishes his, Doreen Virtue, books about angels, all kinds of really neat books. So what she says is, what we're holding in mind in general orientation toward life, that's what's creating our future. And when I first heard that, I went, ooh, that's kind of profound. I want to think about that one. So think about it. What we're holding in mind, as far as general trends of thoughts, beliefs, intentions, emotions, attitude. By the way, the word attitude is a nautical term. It means the course the ship is set to sail. That applies to us, doesn't it? What course are we setting for our ships to sail? You know, what's our attitude toward life, our orientation toward life? And yes, we can change that if we want to. So what we're holding in mind is basically, I believe, that is what's going to get reflected back to us in life. And I think that that is what tailors life specifically and individually to each individual. It kind of makes sense, doesn't it? The way we're holding our ideas about life is what's going to be reflected back to us. In other words, if I'm holding a lot of anger and animosity in life, I'm going to get more to feel angry and animosity about. If I'm holding a lot of fear and consternation, I'm going to get more to feel fearful about. I'm generally a nervous, anxious person, I'm going to get more to feel anxious and worried about. But, on the other hand, if I believe I'm a competent person who can be successful and have self-worth, and what I have to say can be helpful, then we're going to get more of that kind of thing back in life. Now, the reason it's important to consider this is, and Lynn and I have done this talk before, and we've titled it Happiness is an Inside Job. Happiness, satisfaction, and effectiveness in life is really an inside job. That means most of us are kind of unwittingly think that if I just got a better boss, or if my spouse would behave, or my kids would behave, or I got that raise, or I get that car, or I get that new hunting rifle, or whatever, then I'd be happy. But those are all externals, right? They're nice, and they're desirable, but can we really control any of that? Can we really control other people is what I mean. We can't. We can barely control ourselves, our own minds. You know, our own minds run roughshod over us with the kinds of things that Lynn was talking about, you know, with feelings of low self-worth. And, you know, these are messages that are come up as programming. You know, that gets programmed in by tough situations in life, you know, feelings of low worth, you know. And people have different degrees of that. And so, for example, if you had parents who were ridicule you, you know, unceasingly, you're probably not going to walk out of that family with much self-worth, you know. Unless you have the sort of the genetic makeup to fight that, then you might walk out of it really angry. You know, you see how the programming works there? You know, then you got a different kind of problem. Good news is we can resolve anything. We can resolve anything. Any abuse, any substance abuse issue, any worry-based thinking, any problem in life, there's a way through it. There is always a way through it. The methods for for using our mind more effectively are really fairly simple and straightforward. But they're not easy. Otherwise, everybody would be happy, right? Okay? But the evidence is it's not easy. Most people try their hardest to think better, to do better, you know, and that. But what happens is that old programming circles back and again and again and again. Those old habit pattern ways of thinking and believing and those things circle back, and they undermine our efforts. As they undermine our efforts, we tend to succumb and sometimes settle for mediocre lives or misery in lives. And we just think, oh, it's my lot in life. You know, and that's kind of sad. You don't have to do that. I'm here to say that. So we tend to give up trying because it's hard. But if you have a map of the territory of the mind, such as some of the ideas and concepts I'm telling you about today, it begins to look different. It begins to give you some ideas. You can begin to grab onto some things that will persistently help you to tilt the mind in a better direction. So, if you really want out of depression, despair, and you want to find your way out of stressful situations, you've got to use the mind differently. You've got to learn to do that. It's the only way. Okay? But it's the effective way once you have some methods for doing so. So what I'm saying is, on that foundational level of thought, emotion, belief, attitude, intention, on that foundational level, right there is where the feet hit the pavement for change. Okay, right there is where we start disallowing the luxury of miserable thoughts. Or of thoughts that aren't helpful. One way to do that is you can kind of notice the mind. You learn to watch the mind and simply notice what's going through the mind. Most of what goes through the mind is garbage. Useless babble and chatter. You ever get jingles stuck in your head? You know, some stupid jingle kind of keeps going and going and going. The mind grabs onto anything. So a lot of this stuff bubbles up out of old programming thoughts. It's like sewer gas bubbling up. So we kind of have this, what I call this cesspool of a conglomeration of experiences in life, and sometimes genetics contributes to this, that make life feel complicated, okay, that have taught us not to think effectively. And it's not for lack of wanting to feel better or lack of trying, because we try hard. Everyone tries hard. We just don't have a map for the territory. What we can begin to do is, on that foundational level of thought and emotion, we start disallowing thinking that is not helpful. Notice it. The mind has this running commentary going all the time. Right now your mind's thinking, I don't know what about while I'm talking up here. Hopefully it's focused pretty well, you know. But it's probably trying to go off the rails here and there, you know, because that's what our minds do. And but what we have to do is we have to learn on that foundational level to notice thoughts that aren't serving us well. That's pretty easy. All you gotta do is ask the question, is this way of thinking helpful or not? And then what's the second question if it's not helpful? What would be a better way to think or proceed? Okay. Those two questions are pretty helpful, can be pretty helpful. And because you're all smart people, you can come up with solutions if you just ask the right questions of yourself. So these negative trends of thought, the cesspools of negativity, are there. They're within all of us. And they're kind of what I call the lower nature aspect of us. And that's the cesspool we can fall into when we let our mind spiral down the wrong way. We don't catch it. We'll fall into that and then start going down, you know, start taking us down. So the thing is, you notice it and you go, uh-uh, not willing to do, I'm willing not to do that, I'm willing not to think that way, this would be a better way to think, or this would be a better way to proceed, or maybe I need to communicate with somebody, you know, this would be something I need to do to behave, and then you proceed with that. I want to talk a little bit about clinical depression because it's a real buzz killer. And it's very real. So there's all different degrees of depression. There's mild, basically mild, moderate, and severe. And it's kind of a continuum in between those things too. Everybody has some depression every now and then, and they just kind of work through it. You know, we just keep going and a little bit of time and we talk things out a little bit and depression lifts. Okay, that's kind of normal human depression, come out of it, you know. Everybody's probably going to be depressed if somebody you love dies, which is inevitable. It's going to happen to all of us, you know. And so that's normal. So one of the ways out of that with grief is you got to talk about it. You know, you got to talk about your feelings. With somebody. You've got to memorialize that person. You've got to find what it is you want to remember about them. You know? And so, you know, there are normal types of depression that we can just work ourselves out of. I guess in the moderate range, it gets a little tricky. You know? It's because we're looking more at clinical. What I mean by clinical is the neurotransmitter activity in the brain is so fatigued, it's not working right. You know, so if I have a car that's misfiring, I'm probably going to take it to a mechanic. You know? Same with clinical depression. I'm going to have to take myself to the right person, usually a physician, and mostly general practitioners. Most general practitioners will treat clinical depression. They do it all the time. And they treat them with antidepressants. People go, ooh, antidepressants. I don't want to do that. People refuse those. I've seen people refuse them for their children who are profoundly depressed and on the verge of suiciding. That gets our attention. So these meds, what they are, it's not like taking a drug that's going to give us a buzz. They're restorative. What they're doing is they're restoring fatigued neurotransmitter function in the brain. Because when it's not restored, we're going to be pushing the ball uphill and it's going to feel like it's going to roll back on us at any time, all the time. We feel overwhelmed. One of the common signs of depression is being, that people don't realize, is being irritable all the time. Moody. It can be loss of sleep, losing weight, loss of normal interests in life. It could be relationship tension, because if you're irritable, it's going to be tension. And you're not going to be rational. You're going to be pissed off. And so it undermines, and people don't realize it sometimes. So one of the ways I can tell if someone's clinically depressed is I try counseling first. And if all the ideas we're trying, cognitive behavioral therapy, and the ideas about changing the mind and everything, they're not working, then I start looking at the potential for clinical depression. And I might recommend they go see a physician, and I might send some referral information if they will give me permission to do so. And a lot of times they'll come back several weeks later taking an antidepressant. I just had a woman come to me yesterday. She was already taking an antidepressant. But I realized she was still depressed, clinically depressed. Either didn't have a high enough dosage or she didn't have the right med. So I sent her back to her doctor. And her doctor doubled her antidepressant. And the next time I saw her, she was a different person. So much better. She didn't feel overwhelmed. She could think clearly. She could find her way through all the things she couldn't find her way through before. And it was just normal brain activity. It wasn't elevated. It was just normal. She was restored. Okay. I'm not saying they help everyone, but they do help a lot of people. Millions of people take antidepressants, and well, I don't know what we'd do without them. We'd have a lot of unhappy people. Okay. So take the stigma out of that if you think that, man, no matter what I try or whatever good ideas Rob and Lynn teach us, I still can't pick myself up. I don't want to get out of bed. I can't get motivated. I don't like to hunt anymore. I don't like to knit anymore, whatever it is you like to do. You've lost your interest. I don't like to read. I don't want to play with the kids anymore. Everything's overwhelming. That could be clinical depression. And there could be other other illnesses, too, that could be checked out. But I want to say that because probably 10% of the people in the room or more could be having a touch of clinical depression. Okay. I want to be encouraging. I want to say a couple of encouraging comments about stress and despair and depression. Everybody knows the Harry Potter author, J.K. Rowling. Amazing woman. You know that she was near being homeless? Or probably read or seen that. And now she's a keynote speaker at major universities like Harvard and Yale. But before she became a celebrated multimillionaire author, she made this empowering statement. And she said, "Rock bottom became the solid foundation on which I rebuilt my life." So she realized she had to start rebuilding, and she realized she'd hit a bottom, and that's what she set about doing. She found the will and the way to do that, and she just kept going, piece by piece, one step in front of the other, little by little, and it starts making a difference. It starts adding up. She didn't give up. She kept going. She also made this statement. She quoted a Greek author named Plutarch. Ever heard of him? I'd never heard of him before. You have? Okay. Wow.
Got a lit major.
Of course. That's impressive that you've heard of him. Plutarch said, find it here. Well, what he said was, we have to, whatever we're creating as an internal reality is creating our external reality. That supports what I'm saying to you today. So this is where the feet hit the pavement is what I want to leave with today. It's right in here, the mind, and I mean by the mind, I mean mind, body, senses, intuition, everything, the whole package. Okay. And so we've got to use what we got and we start using it effectively. If we have a clinical issue, we've got to clear that up first. Otherwise, all the good ideas in the world aren't going to work. You can't think your way out. You can't analyze your way out of clinical depression. There's no way it's going to happen. Here's what he said. He said, what we achieve inwardly will change our outer reality. That's exactly what he said. And that's exactly what I think Lynn and I are speaking to today, you know. I think it's a very profound statement. Life is not supposed to suck and then we die. You know, it's not. So there can be defining moments in life where we make certain decisions that are major. Because of bad stuff that happens to us, we might decide, well, nobody will ever want me, and start believing it. We might decide that I'll never have enough money. Guess what? If you hold that in mind, what's going to happen? You're never going to have enough money. I'll never trust another man. Or I'll never trust another woman. I'll bet some of you have thought that. You got to watch these nevers, you know. Because they're defining moments, and then they're now inserted into life as rules we live by. So what I say is we have to have redefining moments. You know, we have to challenge those kind of not so good rules that we've claimed for ourselves. We also have to be willing to take complete responsibility for our own well-being and happiness. We don't blame it on anybody, not the boss, not our job, not the coworker, not the government, not the Democrats, not the Republicans. You know, blame is really a self-centered vanity. Okay? That doesn't mean we can't look for problems. Blame is a negative approach to problems. It's a shaming approach. Does a shaming approach work very well with you? I don't think so. Many people, and most people, are prone to doing it, though, sometimes. You know, we default to that. Like, well, you ought to know better. Well, if you knew better, you wouldn't have done it. You wouldn't have done it a certain way. Why do you think, have you ever known anybody that's very steady through great adversity? Have you ever known anybody like that? How do you think they do it? I think they do it. You're a literature scholar.
Comedian.
I like that a lot. Denial is not such a bad thing sometimes. It does help us sometimes to deny realities at first, you know. We got to numb out for a while sometimes before we... So I'm okay with denial, a little bit of it. You know. But the way we stay incredibly... People stay incredibly steady through adversity is they know the stuff I'm talking about. And they have a different set of rules they live by than someone who crumbles or someone who complains all the time. Or allows themselves to get hair-triggered into dramatic thinking, going into drama land, you know. Drama is very seductive. Very seductive. I'm not beyond getting pulled into some drama, you know. I try to get out of it faster, you know. So drama can be very seductive. So we got to resist the temptation to gossip in a negative way about people, excuse ourselves from those kinds of things. Maybe say something good about somebody if you're hearing something bad said about them. But the mind will make mountains out of molehills if we allow it to. Did you know that self-criticism is a form of self-indulgence? See how that might be? If you're self-critical and you're buzzing about how negative things all the time, it's incredibly self-focused, right? It becomes a way of life for some people. And so, you know, we have to look at that. You know, we have to stop criticizing ourselves, stop criticizing others. I'll just give you I've got a great handout. Lynn's got a handout as well for you that's really nice. You already put them back there? She's put them in the back of the room so everybody wasn't reading them while I was trying to talk to you. And I've got, what's in your handout, Lynn, if you want to?
Take care of yourself to help increase your self-worth, look after yourself, and the other one's the first page of the gratitude journal.
Lovely. Wife does a gratitude journal, and ever since she started that, she's been nicer.
You can put that on your gratitude journal.
I don't have a gratitude journal, not me. So... You know what really makes her nice is when she rides a horse. So good after she rides a horse. Give her my blessing. Go ride, honey. Go ride. Okay. So mine, I have a list of 40 ways you can tilt the mind in a better direction. I'm not going to go through that whole list, but I'll go through a few of them. One of them is inserting affirmations. They really do work if you believe in them and you start affirming them and you start reconditioning the mind. So... One affirmation I like is, I'm meant to feel empowered and joyful. And so there's affirmations and ways to use them. There's the idea of asking yourself, is this a helpful way of thinking or not? There's interjections you can use, statements to interject to stop negative thinking. Basically, you resist the temptation to express opinions. Most opinions are vanities. Okay? That's a hard one for people, you know. I love my opinions. Everybody should love my opinions. How about bumper stickers, huh? Yeah? So, you know, you might want to remove any bumper stickers that are pompous, blowhard opinions, or have a shaming or forceful overtone. They say things about a person you may not want people to think about you. You know, there's some good ones though. Wag more, bark less. I love that one. I think, therefore, I'm dangerous. I like that one. Stop complaining. Stop arguing. Stop criticizing. That means internally too. Let go of the need to control others. Tread lightly and in good humor. Stop self-medicating. Find help if you need it. There's an envision. Number 17 is envisioning. It's envisioning what you do want. It's a way of putting in your mind and holding in your mind what it is you really do want. And that, number 17, just make a mental note of that. Make sure you look at number 17 on here. Use, if you're a spiritual person, religious person, use prayer. You know, practice your devotion and your faith. If you're not, find some greater meaning or purpose in life, even if it's just a love for humanity. You know? Find some kind of higher power, even if it's just simply love. You know, it doesn't have to be religious. You know, and one of the most powerful prayers I've ever heard of is to pray for the highest good outcome for all. If you do pray, it's totally unbiased, and it demonstrates complete faith. That's it. And here's how I want it done. You know. So, it doesn't matter to me whether you pray or not, but if you do, you know, this is just some ideas. Learn to meditate. Make peace with peace. Some people can't stand peace. Feel scary.
Scary.
So they want to fill it with something, excitement, and it creates a roller coaster effect. Gratitude, Lynn's already covered that. Read inspiring literature. And I'm about running out of time. Tilt the mind. Remember to tilt the mind in the right direction. And on that foundational level, do that. So one of the things you can do, too, is you don't have to have a big problem to come to EAP. You know, Lynn and I both love just coaching people. Sorry, that's going to be on the record. Just coaching people with these ideas and things. And we can help you keep them in front of yourself, you know. And we can also evaluate to see if there might be some clinical depression that could be treated. So reach out for some help if you want to. Seek to bring your best self to all equations. And let's not get lost in the forest for the trees. The trees are like problems that become myopic. We can't see our way around them. And so we lose sight of the bigger picture, you know, when we do that. So I really appreciate your having us here today to talk, and I hope this has been helpful. Please pick up one of the handouts on the way out. And you all are all A-plus students. So I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day. Have a good day. Thank you.